A quick heads up, this episode includes discussions of suicide and sexual misconduct, as well as some colorful language. Please be advised.
From Wondery, I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And this is Even the Rich. Over the last four episodes, we've followed the transformation of a lonely kid from the foster care system named Norma Jean into one of the most recognizable women in the world, Marilyn Monroe.
That's right. From Andy Warhol's silk screens to that iconic image of her white dress blowing up over her knees, Marilyn Monroe is the ultimate icon.
But the thing is, she's so much more than those mass-produced images. She was a serious artist, an advocate for women in the film industry, the godmother of sex positivity.
Seriously, why do we always only remember women for their looks?
I don't know. I mean, feel free to remember me for both my stunning looks, my wit, my accomplishments.
Your humility.
Yep.
And speaking of humility, congratulations to us on winning that Gracie Award, by the way.
Yes. Best co-host ensemble, obviously.
Okay, but today we're talking about Marilyn's accomplishments. And here to join us is Angelica Jade Bastien. She's a film critic for Vulture, and she's one of Marilyn's greatest admirers.
Angelica Jade Bastien, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us how into Marilyn you are. Like, how does she inspire you? And also, how do you channel her? And how can I channel her?
Marilyn is interesting in the sense that you can see the image of her and be like, oh, I'm so inspired to like own my sexuality and be totally and completely myself. In reality, Marilyn is one of the most anxious stars that has probably ever existed in Hollywood, and really struggled with her own desires and sexuality and her relationship to sex. But what I find inspiring about her and why I'm so drawn to her is she really sat in her vulnerability in a way that I think can be very hard for people. And for me, Marilyn just inspires me to do me. And I try not to look at her so much as a cautionary tale, but an emblem of what can happen when people use your vulnerability against you.
Is there a moment you can point to where you were like, yes, this is who I love. I love her energy. This is Marilyn, and I want to be her huge fan.
I think it was as a teenager seeing a very early role of hers called Don't Bother to Knock. That's when I was like, oh, I get it. I get why people are so drawn to this woman so many decades after her death. And she just has something you can't make in a lab somewhere in Hollywood. It has to just come from the actual person.
So, you know, speaking of Don't Bother to Knock, it is one of her lesser known films, but, you know, you've written about it. And as you said, you loved her performance. So we just want to play a clip and have you break down some of what is going on in the scene and what you love about her performance in this film.
You stop it now, all of you!
I should have known better. You're not cured.
Don't you say that!
Put that down.
You're just like my folks. You want me put away again?
Talk sense!
So basically, Don't Bother to Knock, Marilyn Monroe is a woman who's in a hotel. She's basically unraveling because she lost a man she loved who was a pilot. And soon after that, this is the backstory, she tries to kill herself. She was institutionalized and she's out now and trying to live a life and make sense of herself. And she ends up becoming really obsessed with another man at the hotel. And it just sort of devolves from there with her kind of threatening the life of the kid that she's supposed to be taking care of. Like, it's not a, oh, wow, this poor woman. It's far more complicated than that, which is really interesting. And it ends on not a great note for Marilyn. She doesn't die. Don't worry about that for people who haven't seen it. But it is a very sad note because you kind of know, oh, this is going to be a woman who's probably going to be stuck in a in a system that is very carceral, because that is true of the psychiatric system in this country. As someone who has been in mental hospitals, it is very prison-like. You do not have any control over yourself and your body. You can't even shower by yourself. And so watching that performance, she plays with a real understanding of what it is like when your mind is working against you and you can feel it and you're trying very hard to fight back some semblance of autonomy and security mentally. And it's a really sad, beautiful performance from her, where she's just kind of getting her footing as an actor and figuring out what works. And one of the most heartbreaking things I think about Marilyn Monroe is I don't think we ever fully saw what she would be capable of because of how Hollywood was at the time, because of how she was used, especially by Zanuck and 20th Century Fox. I don't know if any studio at any time in Hollywood's history would know what to do with an actress like her. It's not like they know what to do with actresses most of the time these days.
Right.
Yeah. So I feel like Marilyn's own challenges with mental health have really defined her legacy in a way that can be really demeaning. And I'm wondering, how would you describe the way Marilyn was treated by the film industry and the press when she was alive?
Well, I'm going to quote Marilyn herself in this regard. There's this really wonderful book called Fragments. It's like a coffee table book. And the subtitle is Poems, Intimate Notes, and Letters by Marilyn Monroe. And one of them I was really struck by is from this sort of poetic reverie where she starts by saying, "Actress must have no mouth." And it's always really stuck with me as a very perceptive view at how Hollywood looks at women to this day. They cannot have their own opinions about things. They can't step out of line. They have to play toward whatever is the predominant vision of femininity at any given moment. And I think she was very cognizant of that. And I mean, you read anything about her, and especially from people who really knew her, and you learn she was really fighting against so many strictures, because she wanted to just be a good actress. She wanted to, a great actress, actually. She was really focused on refining her craft, especially as you get into like the mid-1950s when she connects to Lee Strasberg and the Actors Studio and spends like a year in Manhattan living her life and just trying to find herself. And it's really beautiful to think about. There was like a glimmering moment in time where it really did seemed like she was going to do that. Like, she started her own production company. She also understood the camera better than most actors ever do, and like really understood like how to bend the light by moving her body in certain ways. And it's so interesting to hear like someone like Billy Wilder talk about how many takes she sometimes needed, because she was so anxious being in front of the camera and so anxious about not hitting her marks, not doing what she needed to do, and feeling kind of intimidated by everyone around her. And it's just sort of heartbreaking the more you learn and read about Marilyn, which it can be hard to, because you have to sift through a lot of bullshit and a lot of hearsay and a lot of people projecting their own ideas onto her rather than kind of taking her as she was. Mm.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in terms of the way she was treated, what do you think that tells us about how women in general are treated when it comes to their mental health?
This is such a hard subject. I have some theories on the very gendered, racialized, and class aspects of living with mental illness and navigating psychiatric fields. But I think what's interesting about Marilyn is, to me, she exemplifies this weird dichotomy that exists when it comes to mental illness and how like women experience it, where I do think American culture is very, very, very obsessed with watching white women unravel while not like recognizing the structures that are leading them to unravel. And then on the flip side of that is the fact that Black women, women of color in general, are not seen for when they're struggling. Mm. So it's like this obsession with watching white women unravel, which you can see through the history of film from amazing movies like A Woman Under the Influence to not great questionable examples of like intense, I would say, mental health issues or intense anger that reads as madness. Watching Marilyn on screen, reading about her, reading how people talked about her, it really exemplifies that, yeah, the culture will watch these women fall apart, but it does not care about putting them back together. Mm.
Yeah, I gotta say, hearing you say that we're obsessed with watching white women unravel without caring about them, the first person that comes to mind is Britney Spears. I'm wondering if you can talk about the through line between how we treated Marilyn then and how Britney has been treated up to today.
It's funny because Hollywood has basically a history of this with blonde white women who like find fame very early and then struggle as they get older to like find a sense of themselves and autonomy. And, you know, living through everything that Britney dealt with and seeing how the paparazzi reacted to her, it is hard to separate her from this history that Marilyn obviously exists within. For example, watching the Unheard Tapes documentary on Marilyn that's coming out on Netflix, they had some archival footage of Marilyn coming out of a mental hospital after a 4-day stay. And she has to turn herself on, the charisma and all that, as the paparazzi are swarming her as she's getting out of a mental hospital. You know, when Britney like really lashed out and head shaving and all that stuff, it's like, well, of course she did. She's trying to find some semblance of self in a sea of mirror images that people are reflecting back to her and what they think she should be, who she is. And that's really difficult to navigate. And even on a more grounded level, I feel like I've dealt with that. Obviously not the fucking paparazzi. Thank God I would never be famous. But think of moments where you're dealing with people and you're like, oh, they see me in this specific way because I deal with mental health problems. And they can't see what I'm really dealing with. They can only see an image of myself they projected onto me. And that can be very difficult. And for stars like Marilyn or Britney, I mean, they love tearing down beautiful blonde women. It's like it's an obsession. You can't help but kind of connect to that and feel like, oh, this is a continuum I also exist upon. Because I think a lot of women deal with that sort of dynamic of realizing someone has some image of you in their head that doesn't actually exist.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank?
Literally always.
Okay, well, the new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look, and it comes in luxe gold packaging. It feels incredibly high-end, but it is a lot more affordable.
Oh yeah, the Panorama Mascara lives up to its name by giving your lashes panoramic volume and a fully fanned-out look. Its tapered mascara wand catches every single lash, including those hard-to-reach corner lashes. When I do wear makeup, I do the bare minimum, and that's usually eyeliner and mascara and lip gloss. Yeah. And so mascara has to really pop.
Yes.
And let me tell you, L'Oreal, this baby pops.
Yeah. I do love the packaging. Like, I'm all about that.
So if you're looking for an affordable mascara that gives you voluminous, lengthened lashes, you can buy the Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
So as a listener of Even the Rich, you know that audio piques the imagination, which is why we're so excited for Audible's new collection of exclusive thrillers. They feature captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances that really bring the story to life.
Oh, yeah. The next listed on my list is the psychological thriller, The Silent Patient.
Ooh.
So it's all about a therapist who tries to unravel the mystery of a woman who refuses to talk or give any explanation as to why she shot her husband. I mean, it's going to be the perfect binge listen. And you know I love my thrillers.
I can agree. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog.
Yeah, new members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500.
That's audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500 to get started.
So a lot of people don't know that Marilyn Monroe was really ahead of her time in terms of advocating for women in the film industry. I mean, she was calling out Weinstein-like behavior 70 years ago. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so she did an article in Motion Picture and Television magazine that she wrote called Wolves I Have Known. Hey, she looks great on the cover, by the way. Like, it's so weird to, like, look at these beautiful pictures, and then she's really talking about how terrible men have been to her.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
And she says something in there that I actually want to quote that I think sort of encapsulates the piece Wolves I Have Known, where she says, girls in every walk of life have to take great care that they don't find themselves just another scalp on some man's belt. But in Hollywood, we have to work overtime to outwit the wolves. And she talks like it's a really interesting arc in the essay where she goes from talking about like being a young girl in a, like a sort of, you know, cheesecake pinup-y model and like really gaining her footing, and how like men would do things from follow her with their cars to lying to her about being involved with MGM or, you know, various production companies when they're really just using a friend's office to get women to sleep with them, which is like when you think of how cunning and like manipulative these men are. And then she also talks about men who pretended to be really kind to her and like brotherly or fatherly only for her to realize that they wanted to use her. And she also says something I thought was interesting. If you are born with what the world calls sex appeal, you can either let it wreck you or you can use it to your advantage in the tough show business struggle. And it isn't always easy to pick the right route. And it's just heartbreaking because it's like, oh, you already know reading it that she's probably downplaying certain things. And it's still actively terrible. And it continues today in the golden age of Hollywood. I think it was probably even more complicated to write a piece like that because there's no Me Too support. There's no Twitter people like supporting you. She sort of has presaged or like sort of pointed or started something that it's really sort of fascinating to read her perspective on navigating her own sexuality and how her body and that sexuality could be used against her. And I think for Marilyn, she just wanted to create good art. She wanted to feel loved and find a place in the world. And time again, men would disappoint her. And it was not just these men with their casting couches and men in the industry. It was men she was married to. Like, Joe DiMaggio was abusive, which a lot of people don't like to talk about, but it's like, there's stories from her friends where they were like, yeah, like, she had bruises and looked kind of beaten up, and he was just very possessive. And even people who don't, like, think he was straight up physically and emotionally abusive, because I guess they were obsessed with the fact that he would visit her grave so often, leaving flowers and all this stuff, and like missed her and whatever, which I'm like, abusive men can do that. Like, but my mind is going to this one time where she apparently found, and this is a little bit into her marriage with the playwright Arthur Miller, where she's on set for something. She's coming back to the hotel and she finds this letter from him that he probably didn't realize was still like around, where he basically said how disappointed he was in her, how he thought he was marrying an angel, but instead he calls her a whore. And I was like, oh my God, like, imagine reading that. It's just sort of heartbreaking. Like, she did not have the support she needed. And there were people who did care about her, but I think because of everything she dealt with in her past, being moved through different foster homes, like over 10 foster homes in her youth, her mother being institutionalized for her own mental health problems. This is a woman who wanted a sense of family, and life often made that very difficult. She had miscarriages. And yeah, it's just for me, like, I try not to look at her as some lost cause that needs to be like, you know, care for like a sparrow with a broken wing, because I think that's sort of demeaning and on the other end of the spectrum and sort of infantilizing, and people really love to infantilize her. And, you know, she didn't have a father figure and I think really yearned for that sense in her life. And I like totally connect with her desire to create like a family on her own terms and the inability to get to that because of the way the world works against women. Mm.
Touching back on Wolves I Have Known, I mean, mm-hmm. like you said, this was a piece that was not being written by a lot of women back then, obviously. We see this a lot more nowadays. And I'm wondering, why isn't she considered kind of like the godmother of the Me Too movement?
Okay, I'm going to be a little spicy. And that's because a lot of Uh-oh. Second wave feminists, Gloria Steinem, I'm looking at your whack
oh,
ass,
damn!
would write about her in the most infantile, like they would make her seem like a little child and who didn't know who she was. And Norma Jean was the real girl. Marilyn was the fake bombshell. Mm. And it's just like, I think that really warped people like perception of her. So instead of like looking at Marilyn, how Marilyn actually talked about herself, who she actually was, yeah. it's very easy to kind of just grab hold of what other people were saying, whether it's Norman Mailer's whack ass or Gloria Steinem. Like she has this book, which I have, that has pictures from George Barris, like including her like last sitting and all that sort of stuff, and texts from Gloria kind of writing about Marilyn. And I think a lot of second wave feminists like were rebelling against like the previous generation, and they saw Marilyn as an emblem of what was wrong with how women's sexuality was conceived. Mm. And also a lot of second wave feminists, like, sorry to say, were prudes and like were completely weird about the idea of a woman even wanting to have sex with a man. Yeah. And so they ended up, you know, attributing weird ideas to her and then shaping her image for generations to come. So it's very easy to look at Marilyn as what her screen image was, which for most people is like the dumb blonde. Like if you watch Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and actually like engage with her character, this is just a woman who has a very breathy voice. She's actually not an idiot. Like she has a whole monologue at the end with the father of the man she wants to marry. Like, you know, wouldn't you want your son to be with someone beautiful? And isn't beauty for women what money is for men? Like, why are you acting like me using my beauty means I'm an idiot? Like, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I love her for that.
Yeah.
And I've seen so many things where she pops up as a fictional character. And it's always, especially with these male directors, it's always men working out their issues with women because Marilyn is kind of looked at as not just a woman, but woman, like the emblem of all that femininity and womanhood can be.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes people can't separate that from the actual woman.
So in the pantheon of great feminists, what would Marilyn's plaque say?
So I'm going to answer you guys the way I answer my brother when he asked me completely out of nowhere, what would I put on my own tombstone? And this would be it. And I think it fits Marilyn and I can totally see it on some gleaming white marble. Here lies a woman with more passion than the world could handle.
Ooh,
I'm going to put that on mine.
Yeah.
Let's all do it.
Oh, I think that's great, though.
Yeah, no, that's really great.
Life is busier than ever. It might be harder to find time these days to grocery shop, prep, and cook healthy and hearty meals. I get it. But Factor's got you covered.
Yeah, so Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, delivered right to your door, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes.
Exactly. And Factor is tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. If you're traveling or still finishing up last week's meals, you can always pause or reschedule deliveries.
I mean, I know I've talked before about how much I love Factor because it's just so easy.
And it doesn't taste like, you know, the microwavable meals you see, especially in rom-coms when we're trying to heighten and highlight how sad and pathetic this woman's life is.
Yeah.
They don't taste like that. They taste so good as if you made them yourself or hired a chef. Head to factormeals.com/rich50 and use code rich50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box. That's code rich50 at factormeals.com/rich50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
We all face stress in our daily lives. What if the answer to a better stress response is in one key nutrient? I'm talking about magnesium, and specifically Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. This one-of-a-kind product is designed to reverse low levels of magnesium, which could have a positive effect on our stress response. But don't take my word for it. Here's a quote from a 2020 issue of the scientific journal Nutrients. Results suggest that stress could increase magnesium loss, causing a deficiency. And in turn, magnesium deficiency could enhance the body's susceptibility to stress, resulting in a magnesium and stress vicious circle. I only recommend Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. It's the only organic full-spectrum magnesium supplement that includes 7 unique forms of magnesium for stress resilience and better sleep. Simply go to bioptimizers.com/ifstories, promo code ifstories10 to get your Magnesium Breakthrough and find out this month's gift with purchase. That's bioptimizers.com/ifstories, promo code ifstories10.
You know, above all else, like you said, Marilyn Monroe was an actor. And something our series really delves into is that what Marilyn really wanted was to be taken seriously as an actor. So let's just take a minute to focus simply on her artistry. So you wrote this great piece for Vulture a few years ago, and you ranked her 29 films from worst to best. So if you're up for it, we're going to play some clips from a few of your favorite films, and we want you to tell us what film it's from, what's going on in the movie, and what you loved about it. Are you down?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, here's the first one.
Find a gentleman who is shy or bold. As long as the guy's a millionaire.
So that is the iconic Gentlemen Prefer Blondes opening with her and her bestie, played by Jane Russell. And I mean, it's just one of my favorite films of all time. Just because, wow, they were using that Technicolor girl. They knew what they were doing. They're like, we're giving you the glitz. We're giving you the glamour. We're giving you Marilyn walking with Jane by her side. And they're like the hottest broads in the room. And they know it. It's just what I love about classic Hollywood is the ecstasy of it. Like, they knew that film was a pleasure. And so we need to provide pleasure and joy to our audience. They're showgirls and they're traveling, and then they get into hijinks, and you know, Jane Russell's character is like very against men and falling in love, while Marilyn is like, you know, oh, I'll fall in love with a man. Where are my diamonds at, though? Like, where are you paying my rent? Because if not, we ain't talking. And I'm like, girl, you know what? More of us should be like that.
Okay, so this next one, according to your Vulture article, is your second favorite Marilyn film. So we'll play the clip. You tell us the film, what's going on, and what you love about it.
I want you to think I'm a drinker. I can stop anytime I want to, only I don't want to, especially when I'm blue.
We understand.
All the girls drink. It's just that I'm the one that gets caught.
So that is the legendary, the amazing, the powerful, and the film I would actually put number one if I was making the list today. Some Like It Hot, directed by one of my favorite directors of all time, Billy Wilder. And it concerns two men, played by Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon, who are musicians who witness the famous St. Valentine's Day massacre in Chicago and have to go on the run. And they pose as women, joining this traveling musical group of, again, women. And it's honestly one of the greatest, like, slyly queer films of all time, in my opinion. And Marilyn plays Sugar, who is, you know, sings and plays a ukulele sometimes for the group. And I mean, she looks absolutely bodacious, but even better, she really plays this really beautiful mix of, like, romantic melancholy and also absolute hilarity. Like, I have watched it so much during the pandemic when I like feel really low and need some joy, because it's like, even though I've seen it, like I've lost count of how many times I've seen it, it just makes me laugh. And I mean, that ending.
I can never have children.
We can adopt some. But you don't understand, Osgood. I'm a man. Well, Nobody's perfect.
It's like, honestly, great. I'm like, oh, so these men are, I guess, just going to be in a relationship now. Okay, get it, honey. Okay. I love it.
Do you think this character was written specifically for her?
That's a good question. I don't think I've read anything that, like, explicitly, you know, from Billy Wilder saying, oh, it had to be Marilyn. But I'm going to assume yes, because it's Marilyn, and it's, like, hard to think of anybody who could play the role in that specific tone that she could have. And obviously, Billy Wilder, like, you know, knew about her and, you know, her issues by that point, because they worked on the mm-hmm. 7-Year Itch in 1955, so a few years earlier. So I can probably imagine that he did write it for her, which is funny because, I mean, The 7-Year Itch, I hate that movie. I think her performance is great, but I do not like that movie, because I think it's actually really sexist. Like, she's literally just known as the girl in the movie. But she's so much smarter than anybody is giving her credit for. So she's able to do things with that role that I don't think Billy Wilder was expecting.
Okay, so we have one last one for you to listen to.
Ooh, okay.
You ever been outside Reno, Mrs. Tabor?
Once I walked to the edge of town. Doesn't look like there's much out there.
Everything's there.
Like what?
The country.
Well, what do you do with yourself?
Just live.
How do you just live?
One of the most apocalyptic sets. Like, if I could be a fly on the wall on that set, like, what a mess. The man you're hearing talk is Clark Gable, whom Marilyn always had this, like, love for. She was also very close friends with Truman Capote, but I actually want to read something that he wrote about her that I think really encapsulates her performance in The Misfits and what she could bring about. He says, and yes, there was something. An emotional extremism, a dangerously greater need to be loved than to love, the hot-headed willingness of an incompetent gambler to throw good money after bad. And so basically the film, it's basically centered on Monroe as a newly divorced woman, you know, in her time in Reno in Northern Nevada. You know, she spends time with her landlady, played by the great Thelma Ritter. Clark Gable's like an old school cowboy, and Montgomery Clift is like the rodeo riding badass friend of Gable. And it's really just centered on the emotional lives of these characters and them like kind of knowing that they're at either turning points or at the end of the road in their lives. And it's really fascinating, really richly acted film, but the dynamics on set, when I say they are a mess, they are a mess. It was very, I mean, Marilyn and Arthur were on the outs, and so you know, that wasn't good. Like, so that was, and then like John Huston was very worried about Marilyn because she was doing so, she was really ingesting a lot of pills and was in a very bad place in her life. And the film came out in 1961, and obviously Marilyn died the following year. But her performance in it really highlights the romantic melancholy I mentioned from Some Like It Hot earlier. It's a very sweet, sad performance. And there's just an aura of death hovering over it in a lot of ways, because you're like, Clark Gable died before this movie even came out. Montgomery Clift was really in a rough place, and people kind of knew everything was kind of happening as it was happening. And so it was really rough for Marilyn, because it's like, here I am making this film written by the man I'm going to get divorced from, who no longer cares for me, and I'm gonna have to turn on my charisma and all my skill while my life is falling apart. Yeah. There's a really beautiful coffee table book by the photographer Eve Arnold, who is one of the few women photographers who photographed Marilyn during her life. And she was doing like set photography for like Life magazine and so forth. And she had met Marilyn previously and done previous photographs with her, but her photographs on the set of The Misfits, the favorite photograph that comes to mind is maybe unsurprising for someone who's seen a lot of Marilyn pictures, and mirrors often pop up in those pictures. And in this one, it's black and white. The lighting is soft. Eve Arnold is behind her as Marilyn is looking at herself in a large, wide mirror in some public bathroom. Her skirt is kind of hiked up and she's wearing like a nice white tight fitting sort of dress. And she has this sort of faraway glance to her face that seems like she could be thinking about so many different things. Marilyn really, really was great at still photography. She was amazing in front of the camera and could give the camera everything it needed and then some. And the beauty of that picture is it's a moment of vulnerability and almost prosaicness, because it's just her fixing her hair in the mirror with her head cocked to the side while Eve Arnold is behind her, looking at her with a gaze that is not exploitative, but yearning and kind.
Yeah.
What do you think is her most underrated performance?
I think probably it's Bus Stop. From 1956, and she's really stretching her skills there, and it's coming after her break when she, you know, went to the Actors Studio to sharpen her skills with Lee Strasberg, who, you know, was basically the architect of American method acting. And it's really interesting. No one talks about Marilyn as a method actor, but she was a method actor, and it's a really beautiful, you know, sad, lonely performance. I think she really gets across the nature of loneliness at her best. And Bus Stop, I think, is a good example of that.
Well, Angelica, thank you so much for joining us on Even the Rich to talk about the real Marilyn Monroe. Loved hearing your take on her.
Yes, well, thank you.
I always love talking about her. And I just, I think, you know, even though people, in my opinion, are born with an idea of who she is and how she had to navigate things and how she's like a proto-feminist, even if she didn't identify as one. You know, for me, it's very important to talk about mental illness and talk about how it's gendered and racialized and classed. And I think Marilyn is a good window into how that affects people's lives on a material level.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Even the Rich ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today, or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I'm Brooke Sifrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams. This episode was produced by Haley Gray and Peter Arcuni. Kate Young is our series producer. Natalie Shisha is our senior producer. Our audio engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Our executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Marsha Louie. For Wondery.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.